I want to ask you about your seminar as well. I want to ask you about some of the things that you have done in the past. I know you've written some 30 books. I also read Writer's Digest occasionally and have enjoyed your columns. I think that the columns translated into this book.
Yes, they're collected in Telling Lies for Fun and Profit.
Where were you born?
I was born in Buffalo some 46 years ago and grew up there and have lived in New York City for most of my presumably adult life, off and on. I tend to leave the city and come back to it.
What was it like growing up in Buffalo for someone who later became a prolific writer?
I don't know. That's hard to say. Everybody's childhood seems ordinary while it's going on, and mine certainly did. It was sometime, I think, my junior year in high school when I realized that I wanted to be a writer. Before that, that hadn't occurred to me.
How did that realization come about?
I guess my English teacher in 11th grade gave me a lot of encouragement, and I started writing poems and essays and discovered that I had a certain strength in that direction and that I got a lot of satisfaction from it. And also the encouragement was very nourishing.
You went to Antioch.
That's right.
I believe in, as I recall, in Telling Lies for Fun and Profit, you were interested in writing a story about young criminals a la Evan Hunter. Remember that episode? That was among your first writing and your first submission?
That was the first sense I had of what I could write that would be saleable. That was the first experience I had of reading a writer's work and suddenly realizing simultaneously I could write something like this and it would be good to do so. That's right. There was a collection of stories that Evan Hunter had published in Manhunt, primarily. And my first sale ultimately was to Manhunt magazine.
What did you study at Antioch?
I majored in English and probably took as many history courses as English courses. Those were the two areas I was studying. And I started selling. I started writing professionally while I was at Antioch, which led me in my last year there to be rather arrogant as far as schoolwork was concerned. And I had a great deal of difficulty taking it seriously. I went there for 2 years, then I dropped out for a year when I got a summer job at a literary agency that was worthwhile enough so that I wanted to stay with it for a year. Then I went back to the college and had a lot of difficulty readjusting, re-entry problems.
The arrogance of the newly published, is that what
I think said? So, and also I felt, why should I bother with classroom work when I can be doing something that would be simultaneously profitable and have more bearing on the direction I was going, which was probably an accurate judgment, but while I was there, I could have played the game better, I think.
So you were selling stories to magazines while you were in college?
Yeah, and doing books.
And you wrote books as well?
That's right.
What was your first book?
Nothing we any of us want to remember. I did a lot of pseudonymous work in the area of what we would call softcore paperback, the sex novels.
You still have them around the house?
Just for prevention of disease.
Were you somewhat of a campus celebrity or notorious on campus or what?
I think probably more in memory than in fact at the time. Campuses throw up legends after the fact, but I don't know that I was all that notorious while it was going on.
Well, what happened this last, I assume, abortive year of Antioch? What happened to you?
Nothing too much happened. I edited the school newspaper for one quarter and worked on my own writing a fair amount. And then at the end of that year, the school said that I would probably be happier elsewhere, which I felt was very perspicacious of them. I had essentially come to that conclusion myself. And after that, I've essentially been writing full-time ever since. I was briefly employed for a year and a half editing a magazine in the numismatic field, a coin collector's magazine in Wisconsin. And outside of that, that's really the only honest work I ever did.
Well, I wouldn't call what you're doing now dishonest at all. Did you come to New York after Antioch? Or did you go after
Antioch? During Antioch, I came to New York, and I've been in and out ever since. I've lived most of the time in the area here, but I was out in Los Angeles for the better part of a year in the mid-70s, and I moved back to Buffalo once or twice.
Why?
It's hard to remember it. That's not a bad city.
You must be cold-blooded there. I understand the drifts climbed about 8 feet there.
They can.
What was the first book written under the name Lawrence Block?
First book was one called Mona, which was about a sort of a confidence game background. And it was a gold medal book, and it was, I suspect, very derivative, very much like a lot of books published at that time. It took a while for me to find anything approaching my real voice as a writer. I had technical ability before I had much sense of self or sense of what I ought to write about. So while I would not necessarily be inclined to disown those early books, I don't think there's that much of me in them.
What was the first hardcover book written by Lawrence Block?
First hardcover book was one called Deadly Honeymoon, which came out from Macmillan in, I don't know, somewhere in the late 60s.
What was that about?
It was about a honeymoon couple. The bride is raped by thugs on the honeymoon, and the couple, rather than report the crime, go and hunt down the thugs on their own. Mm-hmm. So it's a revenge story. And it was filmed. It's the only one of my books which was filmed. It was not filmed with dramatic success, but it was filmed.
What was the title again?
The book was entitled Deadly Honeymoon. The movie was entitled Nightmare Honeymoon, which was a stunning example of taking a bad title and making it worse, I always felt.
I wonder if I saw that. It has a familiar ring to it.
But you could see it occasionally late at night on Channel 9.
No wonder I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Over the years, you did begin to develop a voice. You said you had the technical ability that preceded some, I would assume, intellectual understanding of the world around you and people's interrelationships. I noticed that in Like a Lamb to Slaughter, there's some very, very nice stories here.
Thank you.
One of my favorite stories was the one in which the doctor siphoned the cognac from the bottle, as well as siphoning the young version of her hymen. Now that was a very clever. Was this some of these are complicated ideas. It's not just like knocking out a detective story, although I don't think that's easy to do necessarily either. But I just wonder, when you're dealing with what seems to be a fable like that, is this something that you have been able to write because of this intellectual awareness, or is this the derivative where you have drawn upon some fable of the past?
No, I don't think I did. I think in tone and the whole general structure of the frame, it was similar to old Mom South Sea Island stories and a variety of other people's. But I don't think much of my writing comes all that much out of intellect. I think I write more out of intuition. And that's one reason when I put the seminar that I teach together, I've always been frustrated by the way writing is taught, because it seems to me that information on how to write has very, very little to do with what enables some people to write and keeps others from writing successfully. And I think it's more a matter of an intuitive sense of story and an ability to have access to one's intuition and imagination. So while some of my stories may have complicated structure, my awareness of that structure was probably operating on an unconscious level while I was writing it. I can't manage that much by calculating things and figuring out what should happen next.
I want to ask you some questions about that seminar, but first, sure. There are a couple of things I want to ask you about with regard to a couple of the series characters that you've developed. Let's talk a little bit about Bernie Rodenbaugh.
Okay.
One of my favorites. Tell me, who is he? What is he like? What does he do?
Well, Bernie's a burglar, and there's really no getting around it. That's what he does for a living. He's not proud of that, but he really gets off on it, and his efforts to reform just never seem to amount to anything. And he's a literate type and a good company. He owns a bookstore. He acquired that in the third book, a secondhand bookstore down in the village. And he steals things from time to time.
Matthew Scudder.
Scudder is an ex-cop who left the force out of guilt and existential angst and has drifted into an alcoholic existence and lives in a hotel near Columbus Circle and operates as an unlicensed private detective.
Evan Tanner.
Evan Tanner had his sleep center of his brain destroyed during the war and has been awake ever since and is a devotee of virtually all lost causes and irredentist movements ranging from the Latvian army in exile to the Flat Earth Society to a movement to restore the House of Stuart to the English throne, and makes a living by writing students' theses for them.
You also have some smaller characters, I don't know if that's the term. You have some other characters that appear in the short stories. A lawyer, I believe.
There's a lawyer named Aaron Graff who is a criminal defense attorney who operates on a contingency basis and never gets to court because, amazingly, evidence materializes that it leads to the dismissal of charges against his clients. And he carries the advocate system of justice to its logical conclusion, I always felt.
What would you consider your most ambitious novel, Ariel?
Most ambitious novel is probably the most recent of the Scudder novels, which is 8 Million Ways to Die. I think that's probably the most ambitious and probably the most successful artistically.
When we're talking about ambitious, what are we talking about? I know when I ask you ambitious, I guess I meant in terms of character development, plot, and
right.
Apply this to that new
Scudder
book.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start doing the Writer's Digest column?
I started that just about 8 years ago. It's been a little over 8 years that I've been writing that. I never thought when I started it that I would be able to go on with it as long as I have, that I would be inclined to or that they would want to have me. But it's been an excellent relationship. And what has surprised me enormously is that I have repeated myself far less than I thought I would. There was a time when the idea that I would have to come up with an idea for a column every month, and it's about a 1,750-word column, I guess, on some aspect of the technique of fiction. And I thought that would be hard to do, and I thought, well, I'll probably be played out in another month or so. But somehow I always find something to write about. And when I edited the columns to produce Telling Lies for Fun and Profit, which is the columns in book form, I thought I would probably have to do a lot of editing, that I would have repeated stuff a great deal. And it turned out there was like one anecdote that I'd rendered twice at that time, about 4 years that I'd been doing the column. And there was one column that was a sort of hodgepodge that I wound up cutting in half and combining with two other chapters. But aside from that, there was virtually no editing except that of changing column to chapter, that sort of textual editing.
I don't think you can say too much about the craft of writing fiction. I don't think you can ever run out of things to say about it when you think about it.
Well, I no longer fear running dry in that respect, because if I find that reading just gives me new things to think about. I read... Well, I've for years now been reading with the eye of a writer, but now I read also with the eye of one writing about writing, and I'll notice things that will spark an idea that will turn into a column. in a couple of weeks or months' time.
You know, there's this apocryphal story about a famous author whose name escapes me. I say it's apocryphal, but maybe it's true. Maybe you know who it is. I don't know. But apparently he was to address a group of creative writing students at a college, and the young people filled the auditorium waiting with great expectation to hear from this noted author who stomped upon the stage, went to the microphone, and said, "Why aren't you home writing? That's my lesson." And he stalked off. And I don't know if that's true.
I believe it is.
I may have read it, attributed it to a couple of different people. But it occurred to me that was a very poor lesson, because I think, and I think you bear this out with every column, probably with your seminar, undoubtedly in Telling Lies for Fun and Profit, that people need to know about the writing craft, about the writing process. And above all, I think they need the moral support that they just can't get if they are in a room by themselves. I think writers sometimes have to meet other writers or people who know something about writing so that they can discuss these things. And I think it would have been a service for this famed writer to have been able to give these students some idea of his own experience as a writer.
Well, as I understand it, that was Sinclair Lewis at Harvard was where I've seen it attributed a few times. I think he was making a particular point. As I understand it, that was the first of a series of lectures, and the rest of the time he was up there and was more forthcoming than that. I agree that that writers profit enormously by mutually nourishing one another. I think probably the most important function of writers' conferences is the interaction of the participants, irrespective of what they hear in the lecture rooms and their contact with established writers. I think it's the community of people who are engaged in the same pursuit that is the most important single thing about writers' conferences and that sort of thing.
The association with writers would go the other direction. We hear, Amiri Baraka was telling me that when he first came to New York after being expelled from the Navy or Army or whatever he was in the service, he came to Greenwich Village and he discovered poets who didn't write poetry, writers who didn't write prose, artists who didn't paint or draw. But people would gather in coffee houses in the village, and they would talk, and everybody would be a writer or a poet or an artist of some kind, but nobody would go out and do anything. And he got tired of that, and he cut his ties with a lot of these early artists back in the 50s because he felt that eventually you have to stop talking and start writing.
Well, I suppose that's true to an extent. Every bohemia has a certain number of people who are there for the companionship and more than for the work. But it seems to me, I was around the village in the 50s also, and I had the same criticism of that crowd as he did. And yet, when I look back, there were a lot of people who were there then, too, who since have gone on to do a lot of important work. And that I don't know that having been there wasn't just where they needed to be at the time.
Are your friends predominantly writers?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Quite a few are, but a great many are not. I think that's just as writers need the company of each other, there comes a time where you also need not to be exclusively involved with other writers. I know a friend of mine out in Hollywood, who is a screenwriter, was looking at his date book one day and realized that, you know, every day for the past 2 months he'd had lunch with another writer or someone in the business and realized that his life had gotten rather narrow in that respect. And mine has not. Here in New York, certainly, I think a majority of my friends are not writers.
What do they do? Truck drivers?
Anything. It
bartenders?
Just about
advertising men?
Anything at all.
Herbert Gold tells me a story I'm going to have on the radio at the end of the of the month. He lived here in New York. He's lived in California now for about 25 years. But when he was here, he claimed that all of his friends were writers, and tells this funny story about even his throat doctor. The doctors were the doctors of writers, and if he had his throat looked at, the doctor had just looked down William Styron's throat.
Really?
Tell me about the seminar, Write for Your Life.
Well, we say it's an experiential seminar rather than an informational one, by which I mean that we try to create an experience in the room that will make a difference in people's writing. And we address a couple of areas, self-expression, increasing the flow of the imagination and the intuition, self-esteem, and basically getting out of one's own way. It's somewhat hard to describe. It does not consist of me standing up in the front of the room and lecturing for 8 hours, which is good for me and for everyone who takes it, that it does not consist of that. It consists of a lot of interactional one-on-one paired processes, and it consists of a couple of written processes. There's an automatic writing process, and there's a spontaneous character creation process. And it is, people ask, some of the questions people ask is, what kind of writers is it for? And the answer is any kind. You know, it's not specifically slanted toward fiction or nonfiction, prose, poetry, whatever. We've had people from all areas of writing have taken it, evidently to their profit. And it's not limited to any writers who've had a certain level of experience. We've had people who have been published, who publish regularly, who support themselves writing, some who've been quite successful. And we've also had people whose interest in writing is rather recent and who haven't done much. It doesn't seem to matter. You don't produce any work for evaluation or read your work aloud or otherwise, or listen to anybody else read theirs.
I'm a little confused. Can you give me a specific as to a direction in which you would help someone who attends the seminar? How would you open it up, for example? Let's say I'm one of the group of 20, 30, or how many people you have in a seminar, and you're there at the head of the class talking.
Okay, I can probably convey it reasonably well, I think, by doing with you what is one of the first processes that we do. And one of the first things that we do is we have a paired process designed to focus on and to vent some of the fear that everybody winds up feeling being in the room and facing a new activity all at once. So we start off having everybody get a partner and draw their chairs facing each other, and then a co-leader and I will demonstrate the process in the front of the room, and then the people will do it with their partners.
Do what?
One person will say, a fear I have about this training is, and finish the sentence, and the other person will say thank you. And the first person will go on, and they'll do that for 2 or 3 minutes, and then switch roles. And we can do that right now. To give you a sense of it, I'll be A, and I'll say it, and when I finish the sentence, you just say thank you. A fear I have about this interview is the whole talk about the seminar will be incomprehensible to people. You say thank you.
That's all I have to say?
That's all you have to say.
All right. Thank you.
Another fear I have about this interview is I'm just not going to be able to think of the right things to say.
Thank you.
Another fear I have about this interview is that I'm going to forget to mention the name of the book.
Thank you.
Another fear I have about this interview is that I'm dressed down too much and I just, it'll throw me off.
I say thank you again?
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, and we would have done this for a couple of minutes, which we don't have to go through now, and then we'd switch, and it'd be your turn.
And I would say why I have this fear.
Right, you'd say a fear I have about this interview.
Well, one of the fears I had about this interview is confronting a stranger and asking questions that are intelligent with a certain amount of depth and not making a fool out of myself.
Thank you.
Another is, of course, not knowing the person well and perhaps finding him difficult to talk to.
Thank you.
How much do I have to ask? how many questions do I have to ask? I get the point.
Yeah. And then we go from that into a fear I have about my writing is the same paired process. This has a great effect of loosening people up and clearing a lot of fear. And then we talk about some of the ways in which fear is an inhibiting factor for writers and ways to deal with that.
Well, I can see this, the way you describe it in this example, as a means of perhaps breaking the ice with other people, but how does that actually help for someone who wants to write, say, a novel, or the sort of things that you write?
Well, what this and all of the processes in the seminar are designed to do is deal with and provide some tools for overcoming the blocks within a person that keep people from doing their best work when they are writing or achieving the best results with their work. So the seminar is, you know, addresses attitudes a lot and winds up stirring people up quite a bit.
Is this a one-shot?
Yeah.
So how long does it last? 2 hours? 3 hours? Or?
No, about eight or nine.
All day.
We've been running from 10 to 6, and starting in the spring, we're going to go from 10 to 7 because we can't fit everything in. We're always jammed for 10.
That last hour, what do you do in the last hour of the seminar?
Just the completion of
a couple of
processes. Do you play
this by ear? Is it pretty well
No, it's quite. It's pretty much the same each time. There's a lot of one-on-one stuff so that it doesn't follow a verbatim script by any means. But it's pretty much structured, and there's room in there for a lot of sharing. People raise their hands and speak up and that.
Why do you want to help people be writers? Why do you want to give them the kinds of inspiration apparently the seminar is aimed at doing? And of course, the books and the column have all very practical mm-hmm. knowledge. The field isn't crowded enough. Well, why do you want to have so many competitors?
Oh, I don't think it works. I don't think it works that way. I don't know that writers are that much in competition with one another. I want to do the seminar, I guess, because it's a very exciting thing for me right now. It's a way of putting my energy out that I've never done before. I'd gotten very frustrated with writing classes. I taught a few. I didn't like the approach particularly. I thought they were dull to teach, and I thought, too, that they didn't really address what was going on with the writer. Let me give you an idea. I was at a writer's conference in August, I guess it was, on Cape Cod, and I had to read somebody's manuscript, which I don't like to do particularly, but part of the deal at this conference was that there was a certain amount of that. And I read this fellow's manuscript. The real problem with it was stylistic. He had overwritten to an appalling extent. The only way I can really describe the level of the prose and dialogue is to say that it would be the equivalent of a program on television on a color set with the color level knob turned way up so that all of the colors were too intense. You know, and it was painful to watch. Reading it, I realized that he was doing this because he felt He lacked confidence in the dramatic potential of the story and of his ability to tell it. As long as he had that thought, I think you could tell him, you know, you're overwriting, this sentence is too strong, this, and give him directions like that, and either he wouldn't be able to change it or he'd just succeed in flattening it out so that it would confirm his fears about the dullness of it. But I think if you could get him to change the thought that his work was dull unless he overdid it, you know, then he might have a chance to write naturally, because this was not his natural way of writing. That was very clear, and yet he felt he had to write that way. So I think trying to teach by looking at someone's work and saying don't do this, or you need another subplot, or your characters aren't interesting, or something like that, I don't think that does much. Whereas I felt that some of the things we do in the seminar can change the way people see themselves and see their writing, and then the writing reflects that change. It's some people have called it a holistic approach to writing, and I think that might be a good way of looking at it.
But in the long run, don't writers do, in effect, what you yourself did? They reach an awareness of what they have done and how it sounds, how it reads, and they do this in an evolutionary process.
That may be. I don't know. There are some people who say that writing can't be taught and that talent is either there or it isn't. I've come certainly not to believe the second part of that much at all, because while I can read something and tell that the person is talented, I cannot read something and tell that the person is not talented, because I've seen too many cases of people who demonstrated no talent for some years and then suddenly managed to hook into something that was already there, to drill for oil in the right spot or whatever it was, and suddenly they had gotten access to a potential that had always been within them. There was a writer back in, I think, the 40s or 50s, whose manuscripts were passed around editorial offices and laughed at, which is hard to do because editors have seen everything, and the response to bad work is simply boredom and irritation, not to be moved to laughter. And this fellow was so bad that he was notorious for it. One would never have thought he would wind up writing successfully. And he did. He did. He had several novels published. He did very well as a screenwriter. He somehow overcame something. Now, so I can't know that anybody's untalented.
I don't know if this carries over to writing, because I'm sure you could be a dumb, dull, poor writer at 66 and a brilliant writer as William Styron was at 26 when he published his first novel.
I would think. I also don't know whether being bright is no guarantee of writing success. Certainly there are people whose intellect just gleams and they never yet written a paragraph that anyone would read with any pleasure or satisfaction. And other people who are, you know, a long way from intellectual stars, who just write like a dream.
Lawrence Block, we've talked almost 10 minutes longer than I budgeted for, but certainly been interesting talking to you, illuminating, finding out about yourself and about the seminar. I'm still a little vague about what you do, but I think I have an idea when you mention holistic approach. I wish you the best. Do you have a full schedule of seminars over the next year?
We will be starting in March in New York, and then we'll be having about a dozen seminars this spring, and probably a dozen more in the fall.
You're running this out of your home?
That's right.
On Horatio Street.
That's right.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you very much.
35 minutes with me, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.